Hi, I'm Heige, your host for A Writer's Life, a place where I'll be in conversation with fellow authors. We'll discuss all things writing, they'll read from their latest work, and we'll go and explore what happens beyond the pen in a writer's life. It's going to be a page-turner. I just know it. Pull up a chair and join us. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Writer's Life. I'm recording on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Squamish Nation. I'm honored to be in conversation today with Stella Harvey, who was my mentor in 2019 at Simon Fraser University's Writer Studio. Stella Harvey was born in Cairo, Egypt, and moved to Calgary as a child with her family. Stella founded the Whistlers Writers Group, which each year produces the Whistlers Writers Festival and other literary programming under her direction. For her substantial contribution to the literary arts in Whistler, Stella won the Champion of Arts and Culture Award given by the Whistler Chamber of Commerce. Stella is a fiction writer whose short stories have appeared in the Literary Leaning Anthology, the New Orphic Review, Emerge Magazine, and the Dollhouse Review. Her nonfiction has appeared in Piquette News Magazine, The Question, and The Globe and Mail. She currently lives with her husband in Whistler, but visits her many relatives in Greece often, indulging her love for Greek food and culture and honing her fluency in the language. Signature Edition published her first novel, Nicholas Daughter, in 2012. And Sikola Joe Publications of Athens published her Greek translation in 2015. The Brink of Freedom was published in October 2015. Finding Caledora is Stella's third novel. Welcome, Stella.
Thank you so much, Heige.
So I'm going to just get right into it. What was it like around your dinner table when you were growing up?
Lots of discussion, political discussion. My parents both had lots of opinions, and all of us actually are quite, there's only, you know, three of us, and all of us had lots of opinions. We had lots of discussions around the dinner table. It's likely because we were immigrants to Canada. We always adopted other people. We didn't have an extended family in Canada. And I think I still have that tendency of acquiring people. All of us. I remember, especially at Christmas or Thanksgiving or other, you know, Easter or whatever, my mother would cook for an army, and we would invite neighbors, and we, the children, would invite our friends. And somehow, I don't know, in that little bungalow, somehow my mother could fit, you know, 15, 20 people around the table. I really have very fond memories of that. I also, at the same time, I think, have memories of that missing of the extended family. But loud is what it was. Loud and opinionated.
Sounds like you could get a lot of good materials from that time and those kinds of conversations, lots of characters to put into some of your novels.
Yes, I think so. I think initially, though, for me in junior high and high, and later in high school, I was the editor of the school newspaper and had all sorts of opinions, wrote a lot of different things in the newspaper. In fact, I found these things in my parents' house after they passed away. And I just, some of the letters I wrote, I was going, what did I know when I was 16 about a woman's right to choose? Nothing, but I wrote about it. And I remember one time, I was, 16, 17, I guess. First job was at Sears, bussing tables in the cafeteria. I'd written a letter to the Calgary Herald, I think. I probably still have it. My mother had kept it. And so I found it after they passed away. I was working that night. The letter was about capital punishment. My strong views against it. So I was working and somebody called because a woman found my parents' phone number and phoned, and you started yelling at my mother about, how could you let your daughter write such things? And because I made references, I think, to the Bible or something. I don't know what it was. And my mother said, my daughter has her opinions. She has a right to those opinions, and she can express them anywhere she wants to. So I think I started with it from an opinionated point of view. And then moved into fiction a lot later in life, found my way back to writing a lot later in my career, I guess, in my life.
Nice. That leads me to the next question. What was your first piece that you had published?
Aside from you being those letters to the paper? Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I think probably the Peak News magazine here, I would think. I'm not sure if it was a short story if it was a nonfiction piece. I think it was a nonfiction piece that I co-wrote with someone else, the Pemberton writer Lisa Richardson. And we did it together, contemplating the soul of Whistler. I think that's what it was, the first piece I think I had published. Yeah, a long time ago now.
What inspired you to create the Whistler's Writers Group?
I think, you know, when I moved here, I had been living and working in Europe. I had spent a year in England consulting. Then I spent 2 years in Italy, in Rome, also consulting and starting the company's office in Rome, the company I worked for at the time. And my husband and I decided to come home back to Canada and settled in Whistler, where we had a cabin, and thought, well, it would be, we were actually going to travel around Canada and BC specifically and find out where we were going to live when we grew up. But, you know, after about 2 weeks in Whistler, we decided to stay. And this now in August of this year will be 21 years that I've been in Whistler. I've never lived anywhere this long. And anyway, in any event, I sort of thought, I had always been encouraged to write, but had never really pursued it because I had another career and trained for something else and did something else in my life. So I thought, well, this is my time to take a year off and write. So that's, and I didn't know anything really about it. I mean, I did a lot of writing in my career, but not a lot of fiction writing in my career. And there were no resources here. So I went to the librarian at the time, I remember, and Joan Risho, and saying to her, is there a writing group here? And she said, there isn't one, but why don't you start one? And then I'd have a tendency to run before I walk. So I put an ad in the paper. And I think for that meeting, the first meeting, about 23 people showed up at my door. And that's where it started. It just was a way to meet other writers. And initially, it was just open to anyone. Whoever showed up, we would talk about writing and critique each other's work, whoever was there. And then as it grew, it became much more focused on critique. Then there were other critique groups that were formed out of the main group. So the main group, you know, had a social arm, basically, where we started to meet, you know, maybe two or three or four times a year and had a potluck in my house and talked about writing. And then there were critique groups that met monthly to talk about their writing. And really, I went to a session one time on the Sunshine Coast, actually, with the author Andrea Schroeder. Having gone to that, it was a two-day thing, I think, two-day workshop. And I came back and said to my group, we should start a festival. And so the first festival was about 20 people in my living room. And actually, I invited Andreas. And he was the instructor, and he was also the reader. He read from his work on the Friday night, and on the Saturday we had workshops all day, and he reviewed people's work. And that was, you know, that was the start of the festival. I mean, God, now it's a lot bigger than that. They're not in my living room anymore.
No, you'd have to add on to your house.
Yes.
How do you choose what authors to feature in the festival?
That is so hard, because I could invite everybody. There's just so many wonderful authors, but we do an evaluation at the end of every festival. So first and foremost, I look for the suggestions of participants that were here and who they'd like to see, because I'd like to honor that, if both from the perspective of authors they'd like to see, but also workshops they'd like to see. Our festival has both workshops as well as reading events. So it is for the emerging writer as well as for readers, you know, the general public. Whatever we find in terms of, or is noted in terms of evaluations, I look for that first. And then I have relationships with all of the, most, I guess, of the publishers in Canada. And so publishers are constantly pitching their ideas and their authors to me. And I have a board as well that I report to. So they will also have suggestions. And then we have an independent bookstore here and the library, all three libraries, Pemberton, Whistler, and Squamish. So seek out suggestions from all of those sources as well. And hopefully what happens is that some of the suggestions marry up or come very close to some of the authors who have new books coming out. And presto, it happens. But it's a brutal, brutal process for me. The one thing I say, I'm not a procrastinator. I never procrastinate. But when I have to send the letter back saying, I'm sorry, I couldn't place you in this year's festival, like, it breaks my heart. I wait till the absolute last minute because it's hard. It's hard for an author, especially with a smaller publisher, to get noticed. Yeah, as much as I can't place everybody. We do have some 60 authors that come to the festival every year now. So, but it's still, there's so many more authors out there that are having books released. And that's the worst part of the job, I just want to say.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I know I was fortunate enough to be part of the Whistler's Writers Festival. And I think it was your first time that you actually put into the program new voices. When I was there, I thought it was such a wonderful opportunity and was really a nice introduction to the writer's realm and made some really nice connections with people.
Oh, that's great.
It's a wonderful festival, and what a nice location as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's before the year that you were here, Haiga, what I try to do is I try to actually have new voices at the same time on the stage, I guess is what I should say, on the same stage as, you know, people who are quite well known. And it's interesting because the public comes, I've been told this many times, I came to see so-and-so and I discovered so-and-so. So I've always done that. But the year that you were there, I wanted to do something that specifically highlighted new voices, as opposed to having them intertwined with others. And it was an incredible event. So I take one or two events that I'm going to do something completely different and see what happens. That event that you were a part of worked really, really well, except I worried about, does it take it away from the being weaved in with the more experienced voices? And so we haven't done it since the year you were there. We had the pandemic. And so we we went virtual last year. Not my favorite thing. So we reduced the number of programs. So it will be something I do consider again. But, you know, it'll depend on what happens going forward, particularly because of the pandemic.
Yeah, I can see that. I know for me, it was such a wonderful learning experience, mm-hmm. and the connections were huge. I really appreciate it. I hope you do go with it again, because it does really give a really nice opportunity for new writers.
Yeah.
When do you start work on planning the next festival?
It almost starts the day after. It's really interesting. I start to get pitches, and of course, I'm getting evaluations and summarizing those evaluations right away. I started getting pitches from publishers and others, actually. People pitched themselves as well, probably in November. And I try to stall until January. It's a lot of work to put something like this together. And we have a very, very small team to do it, and really, it's a lot of work. So we're around January, and the idea is to finalize the program sometime by the end of June, because in regular years, when we don't have a pandemic, finalize the program mid-June, then send the material to the person I have who, you know, does all of the posters, the program, the collateral for the festival, and then also updates our website and ticketing system and all of that sort of stuff, so that we have tickets on sale. Typically, the weekend after the long weekend in August. We stalled that last year because there was no need. We had a virtual festival, and we had really, the collateral was what was online. We didn't do posters. We did a few posters, not many. Everything was online, and we were using virtually to our blogs, our newsletter, etc., to get word out to our regulars and also to others.
All three of your novels mostly take place in Greece. What about that country inspires you?
Well, I think for me, it's probably home. And but I think throughout my life, in my entire life, in fact, I've probably missed home. It's interesting. Someone said to me at a reading I did with my first book in Calgary, why do you focus on Greece as opposed to Egypt, which is where you were born, in Cairo? I said, yes, I was born in Cairo, but I was born into a Greek community, into a Greek family, and raised Greek. Even in Calgary, Alberta, my mother somehow found feta cheese in the days when you couldn't find feta cheese. And she made Greek yogurt when you couldn't buy yogurt in Calgary. It's probably because I was raised Greek, with all the Greek traditions, Greek Orthodox Easter, we went to the Greek Orthodox Church, you know, all of that sort of, it's something I missed. I went back to Greece for the first time when I was 16, and we went as a family. It felt like going home. And interestingly, I think it is probably the way people, the importance of family, the importance of community, the importance of it's a different kind of lifestyle, I think. It's a different kind of lifestyle, because I felt this. I worked in Italy for 2 years, felt the same way about Italy, because it has the same sort of feel to it. You know, I remember getting off the plane as I was going into a project I knew nothing about. And then getting off the plane in Rome and going, I feel like I've come home. Weird. But I think it's that. I think that's what was the attraction in all three novels. I think with the second novel, The Brink of Freedom, because I had lived in Europe and the refugee crisis was a big issue, even when I was living in Europe, which was the late 1990s, I returned to Canada in mid 2000. It was a big issue then. And every night, Rome, on the news, it'd be refugees, and also quite big in Greece when I was there in 2012, finishing my first novel, Nikolai's Daughters, and starting the research on the refugee crisis in Greece.
What drew you to write your first novel, Nikolai's Daughters?
I was at the time in Greece traveling and thinking about what life would have been like to have been raised, you know, born, raised in Greece, or if my family had chosen to immigrate, or not immigrate, but to go home, to go back to Greece, as opposed to immigrate to Canada. And I met someone in my search for my grandmother's village and her history. You know, I did find her village and find some of her history. Anyway, I met a person there at the municipal hall where I was asking some questions, etc. She was my age. We started talking about her life. And she was really my inspiration. I just sort of thought that, wondering, because you start to think like we were the same and yet we've had such different lives. I remember her saying, do you have a card or something? You can give me your phone number because and your email address. I'll go to the internet cafe and email you if I find anything about your grandmother. And I thought, you mean you don't have a computer at home? Or, it was just... So it was that kind of lifestyle, and her life as she was talking about it was so different than mine. It was really, that was the impetus of that book, and where that was part of it. And then I discovered something in Calavrita, which was tragic World War II massacre. Boys over, any males over the age of 12 years old. There had been, the Greek resistance had fought against the Nazi occupation and that sort of thing during World War II. I really had only wanted to find some place for my character that was not a tourist location. And I found Calavrita and the Akofto, and then I found its history in the school where the women and the children under 12 were locked up, and actually the school was set on fire, but they escaped. There are testimonials of people who had survived that massacre. And there was a man who had to be in his 80s or maybe more, I don't know. But he said, I was listening to his testimonial, but I was reading the subtitles. He said, I don't know what happened that day that made me want to lie about my age. But I lied about my age and I was sent into the school and I survived. And then he started to cry. He said, but I lost all my friends. It really, for me, I wondered what it meant to live with that guilt for your whole life. Because here he was, he had survived, he'd had a family, he talked about so many things, but at that moment, it was the tragedy, and he didn't understand why he lied. He didn't even know what was going to happen. Nobody did. It was after they discovered that the Nazis had taken them up this particular hill. It's now called the Place of Sacrifice. Just gunned them all down and killed them. And so even though I started with one idea about, how's my life different? How would life be different? It was raised in Greece or whatever. It turned out that what really this was, what Nikolai's Daughters turned out to be, was about the impact of war and the impact on subsequent generations of that kind of trauma.
Yeah, I relate to that because when I had taken a trip back to Germany, I hadn't gone until, we immigrated in 74, and probably 15 years ago, I went back for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, the same as you, what would have my life been like had we stayed? Mm-hmm. And some part of me always thought my life would have been better. But when I was there, I realized how fortunate I was to actually be able to live in Canada. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't decided to write my first novel, which is also about Nazi Germany, mm-hmm. and two boys. It happened for me when I was walking down Kurdafendamstrasse, and there was a huge cathedral that had been blown out, mm-hmm. and couldn't wait to come home and actually really begin writing my story. So it's interesting how, as immigrants, as young children, we think, oh, my life could have been better. What would it have been like? And mm-hmm. yet, I think it's really important to go back to your place of origin mm-hmm. and see for yourself
what
would have been like.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting too, like you were saying, from where you got ideas for your own book, right? From being there. Did you do a lot of research as well?
I did. I spent almost 10 years researching. And the nice thing, not nice, but both my parents were children during Nazi Germany. My dad was born when Hitler came to power in 1933, and my mom was born in 1938. Mm-hmm. So they both have accounts well, I don't know my dad's stories, but I do know my mom's and her account of having to escape from the Russian advancing Red Army, which really helped inform me about my novel, which was great.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's great to hear that.
Your second novel, you write about the plight of refugees in the Mediterranean area. Can you talk a little bit about what sort of research you did for that novel?
Yeah, there was quite a lot of research. Again, this was something that bothered me both, probably because I'm an immigrant, but also and had such an opportunity to come to Canada, which my parents were always very thankful. So many refugees. It was a constant issue, for a lot longer than North Americans were, for example, aware of. And I think when I was in Greece finishing Nikolai's Daughters is when I started to see what was going on in Greece in terms of the refugee situation. And also, it was at the same time, 2012, when the economic situation, the economic downturn in Greece was also happening. There was a lot of, the start of Golden Dawn, which is the, was the far right wing party in Greece. It now no longer exists because they were all arrested, thank goodness. I wondered about Greek hospitality. Greeks, period, are known for their hospitality. And then you had this, the rise of the Golden Dawn, as well as all these refugees coming in. So I wondered about that. So my question started around what had happened to Greek hospitality. In any event, my research, I went to speak to the consulate general in Vancouver. I just remember he's now back in Athens, and we've stayed in touch. He's been very helpful to me in terms of my research. But when I went to see him, I said, well, I want to write a book about the refugee crisis in Greece, and I've got these characters and whatever. And I'd like to go to a refugee detention center when I'm in Greece. I'm leaving, in about 6 weeks or whatever it was, a couple of months. And he looked at me and he goes, why is it that you want to write about this? I talked to him about that. And then he said, well, why don't you put a proposal together for me? And I met him on a Friday. Anyway, he said, put a proposal together for me, and we'll see what, we can do. And so I did, and I sent it to him on Monday. I emailed it. And then I'd said by the end of that week, I had a phone call from the Greek embassy in Toronto. Again, so why exactly do you want to write this book? So again, I explained, and this lady was also incredibly kind to me. And by the time I left, so I didn't only want to visit a detention center. I wanted to visit a detention center. I wanted to, the woman who I read about in the Greek newspaper, who had started the refugee office for the government of Greece. I wanted to go through the refugee process, like, what happens when you show up at the door and what process do you go through for managing refugees, for documenting them, for seeing if they have, some other place to go or family or whatever, and what their plans are. And there were some other things I wanted to do. There was a reporter who had written extensively about Golden Dawn, the rise of Golden Dawn, the far right party. By the time I left, I had an appointment to visit the largest refugee center in Greece, which is just outside of Athens. Several other things had been set up for me, so they were just incredibly, incredibly open. I've been asked in different, whether it's during it through a book club or when I've done readings or whatever, well, do you think the Greek government wanted you to say certain things? I said, there was nothing that was kept from me. Like when I went to visit the center, well, it was an interesting experience, but anyway, because the person who was in charge had been advised that I was coming, but he was called away for something. And so I show up at the guard house. I'm Stella Harvey. Here's my Canadian passport. And I'm supposed to see. The two guards looked at me and, what do you want? And So then I tried to explain in my bad Greek what I'm doing there. Question, you know, they went, sit over there. And there was a, you know, sort of like a park bench. And so I went to sit on the park bench and I started to call the woman that was going to be my contact. That was the other thing. They gave me a contact person in Athens. I started to call her on the cell phone and she wasn't answering. And then a van comes up and two men come out of the van and they point to me. They, you know, tell me to come. So I go, you know, I go with them and I'm sitting in between the two of them. They both have guns and they take me out of the compound and actually where the detention center was, because this facility was actually where I was asked to report, was a training facility for police officers and what, but the actual refugee center was at the back of this compound. So we're driving a few blocks and I'm going, I wonder what's going to happen to me. Went through some different gates and then they let me off. And actually there was a sergeant and lieutenant there that greeted me and then they answered my questions. And then the person, the commander that I was supposed to meet, eventually did show up and they did take me on a tour and all of that. Actually, the officer that, funny story, the officer that took me on a tour was a man who had another job. He'd been a police officer, but he'd lost his job during the economic downturn. And so he was working in this place. And so he started talking about how important the work he was doing was. And while he missed police work, he felt like he was doing something really important here. And I looked at him and he had actually the same kind of build as one of the characters in the book. And I went, don't you know I created you? Because he sounded, looked like somebody I'd already created. If he'd had the same name, that would have been wild, but he didn't. Anyway, long story. Sorry.
That's really great. That's funny. What struck you the most about a refugee center?
You know, in terms of my own history and my career, I'm a social worker by training. And so I had worked in an institute. I've worked in a prison before, both in a young offender center and in an adult center, but years ago. I wasn't bothered per se by things like the towers and the, you know, barbed wire and all of that kind of thing. I think it was, for me, I wondered about the people. The people who were behind those fences. And in fact, I blogged about this after, because I blogged about the entire time I was in Greece working on my second book. At one point, the week after I was there, somebody had died in custody in that center. I had wondered if I had seen that person, you know, and I just wonder about what happens to people. And it really motivated me. Again, probably because of my training, I just wanted to go back and work there. There were some, you know, there were medical facilities, there were all sorts of other things, but a jail by any other name is still a jail. And I just wondered about the future for these people and what would happen. I just also felt like it was so horribly unfair. You know, you want a new life, a better life. A lot of them fleeing war and other horrible things, and to end up in a place not sure when you're going to your refugee status is going to be processed, all of that kind of stuff. I just stayed with me. And in fact, just outside of Athens, and when they brought me back to the gate where I started my adventure, I called a taxi. The taxi came to get me and he looked at me. He goes, what is it? Why are you out here? And so I explained, you know, I was doing research, blah, blah, blah. He said, this is our shame. This place is our shame. And I thought, yeah, there has to be a better way. And it's not just for Greece, for me, and here comes my opinionated side, I apologize, but for all of Europe and the world. You know, you can't have people displaced. More people are displaced now than ever before. In few countries that happen to have borders, deal with people. We have to have a worldwide policy in terms of what we do, people who have displaced and have to flee their countries for a better life, and just to even to save their lives.
Yeah, I agree. Did you get a chance to speak to any refugees?
They didn't want, I couldn't take any pictures, couldn't do any of that sort of thing. No, not there. I did frequent sort of some neighborhoods in Greece where, in Athens, I mean, there were refugees, but I also went to a Roma camp, you know, the gypsy camp, because the book, The Brink of Freedom, really focuses not necessarily on, in fact, not at all, on the refugees who are protected by international law, or should be protected by international law, Syrians, Afghanis, Iraqis. But I wanted to focus on the refugees and other peoples that don't quite fit into international law. They may be fleeing, want a better life. There's no jobs where they are. There's no opportunities. There's gangs, there's violence, whatever it is. But it's not considered under international law as a reason why you would leave your country. And a lot of those people are a lot of times sent back. The Roma is another group of individuals that have made their home in various parts of Europe, but have never really been accepted. I did visit a Roma camp outside of Corinth in Greece, and that was also an experience as well, but it was an eye-opener as well. Lots of poverty. It was a place, a farm. It was sad because the person who I met, who was working there, she was from Switzerland, I think. She picked me up in Corinth and drove me out there. She said, "See those olive trees? They're 500, 600, 700 years old. And there were other ones that were burnt down." And she said, "They've been burnt by the Roma because they need firewood. They've taken over this farmland because, you know, probably family, you know, died and left it. Taken over, moved in their shacks and lean-tos and whatever. And, you know, they've been taken over, but they need firewood. So they cut down these olive trees and burn them down. It's really sad. It was sad all around. But at the end of the book, though, trying to finish on a positive note, is I did find hospitality. I did find Greek hospitality, because what would happen, I would go in the neighborhood, they had these dumpsters because you'd take your garbage out to the dumpster and whatever. Greeks would leave bags of their leftovers on the hooks of these dumpsters for people. Or if you went to a restaurant, for example, they would take the whatever leftover and give it to somebody on the street. And there were lots of groups that were feeding refugees were not in a center, but were on a street, were living in not the greatest conditions. So I came back and answered my own question at the end of the book. So hospitality has not died in Greece.
That brings me to my next question. I'm really excited to hear you read from your third novel, Finding Calidora. This is a novel that spans four generations. Could you delight our listeners and read an excerpt from Finding Calidora?
Yes, thanks for asking. I will read two little excerpts, I guess. And the first one is a prologue, and this happens in present day. She gazes out the car window at the olive trees in the fields between the narrow road. They stand unmoving in the wind, although the sea beyond is ruffled with whitecaps. The sea and the sky here are blue she has never seen anywhere else in her travels. This is home. She has felt it in the surge of her chest every time she's come to this country, looking for her past, a place where she might belong. "It's useless, Pithimu," her father had told her. "We'll never find what you're looking for. Too much time has passed." But she knows this is home, even without any concrete proof. The stranger they'd met only a few hours ago says something to her father and points. The two men are sitting in the front seat of the car, and she leans forward from the back trying to make out what the man is saying. E, land. She understands the word and follows his finger. This land is closer to the sea. There are more olive trees here, and in their pale green midst is a house of stone. The roof has collapsed and the stone is muddied, but the structure stands. There is no front door or glass in any of the window frames. Tattered sheets of plastic flap against the sides of the house. It must have been a family home at one time. She sees the oleander bushes dotted in flowers of her favorite color, fuchsia, and is sure the scent reaches her even at this distance. Someone must have cared about this place once. Once upon a time, she thinks. This is how all her fantasies begin. She has a tendency to romanticize spaces, build stories of hardship and triumph for the characters she makes up. What if? She dreams of reconstructing the shacks she has seen all over this country, restoring them so they can be loved again. She dreams one of these shacks is hers to love. "I don't know why," the man says, "but that piece of land has always had a name, a woman's name. I have never changed it." He takes his eyes off the road and turns to look at her father. "Was the right thing to do?" When the man says the name, she reels back in her seat. Tears pool, and she swallows hard, trying to keep them at bay. Still they come, after all the dead ends, the bureaucracy, and her family's warnings. She has found it. So that's a prologue. And then this piece that I'll read happens 100 years before that. Taking a breath, Caledora felt a sharp pain rip through her chest. She swallowed and hoped she hadn't broken a bone. She was far too busy with the farm for such a calamity. The sky was as dark as the night her sons left for the war. Still, the stars shimmered, so many she couldn't begin to count. Had they always been this bright? As she gazed at them, her body calmed, the throbbing in her chest subsided. She'd answered the door after the third knock. She thought it had been Katrina finally coming home, but there had been no one at the door. She now recalled she'd heard a loud crack and smelled gunpowder, but that hadn't been uncommon given the war. She couldn't remember anything else. Perhaps she'd banged her head. She tried to get up, but the pressure on her chest held her down. She raised her head slightly and spotted a stain growing against her blouse. Her shawl dangled off one shoulder. She let her head sink back to the cobblestones beneath her. Her arms shook by her sides. Winter was coming. Before he left, Nikos had told her to stay out of harm's way. "You are a woman. This is not your fight." One day she would tell her son how she found her place in this battle, and he would realize how much he'd underestimated her. Vasilis had said, "We need you," and held her tightly before he joined the war. She had been the one to break away. "We'll be back together soon," she said. Her sons worried too much about her. They were such good boys. She heard footsteps approaching rapidly. Finally, Katerina was coming back to the front door. She'd probably been on another rendezvous with that fool Stavros. Her daughter needed to stay away from that family. She had told Katerina this. Stavros and his family were royalists, cowards like the king himself, who had wanted to stay neutral during the war. Shameful. How could any Greek remain neutral when the Ottomans were involved? These people had been the enemy for centuries. "People don't care about politics in our village," Katerina had said. "And besides, we are at the edge of this country. No one cares about us." She felt a whoosh of air and the break of branches as a foot connected with her shrubs. "Stupid, ugly things." Who had said this? And what were they talking about? She felt a kick against her ribs and grimaced. A torch was held in a hand above where she lay. She tried to pull up her arm to shield her eyes, but it refused to move. Her candle hadn't been that bright. Where had it gone? She had to be careful with the smallest of flames after the tinder dry summer. "Can you help me up?" she said, and extended her hand. Her arm, too heavy to remain stretched out, fell by her side. The ache in her chest glowed red hot, similar to those early days after Theo's death, when there was no end to the waves of pain she endured. Just as she'd done then, She took shallow breaths. That daughter of yours is exactly like her wandering father. She has put stupid thoughts into my son's head. This is your fault. You helped the Prime Minister's collaborators fight and gave them refuge. And she followed your example. You didn't know how to stay objective. You should be like other women, a mother, not a warrior. And your daughter's father was just as useless. From a bad crow comes a bad egg. The torch blinded her. She couldn't see his face, but she recognized that high-pitched, spineless voice of his and the way he threw old expressions around as if to say, "Look at me, see how smart I am. This bad Greek, this traitor. He was a disgrace to his country, to his village, and to his family." And to think, she had insisted in the face of Theo's resistance on embroidering that tablecloth for this man and Theo's sister, Stamatula, when they married. Nestor? That bullet was to avenge my son, the son your daughter bewitched. She's the one who put stupid ideas in his head. She's the one who made him run away. Run away? How? You're her mother, if anyone should know. Help me up, Calidora said. We will discuss this, find a solution. We are neighbors and family, not enemies, never enemies. She choked on these last words and began to cough. She licked her lips, dry as some of her scorched fields. She watched the torch fly over her head. The flame exploded into an intense light inside her door. The twinkling stars above her, there a moment ago, disappeared. Over the roar rumbling in her ears, she heard his footsteps as he ran away. The ground beneath her was colder. She'd never known such a bitter chill. Thoughts of her children came rushing in, as babies, as toddlers, as near adults. Then the images of Nikos, Vasilis, and Katerina faded, and her dead husband, Theo, stood above her. He held out his hand. She wanted to ask him what would happen to their children. Would they come home, find each other? He smiled, but it didn't reassure her. Will they settle, Theo? Settle on this land, the land you named Calidora.
That was wonderful. Did you pull from your family stories?
Yes, this novel is much more autobiographical. There's a lot of fiction because so many people are gone. Yes, some of the stories are stories I heard growing up from my parents, and then later when I went to Greece from my grandparents and from my family, my cousins and my aunts. But some of it is also history, you know, history of what happened in Greece. So it's very much a historical fiction novel. But yes, there's a lot of, it's the only one, actually. Some of the others, I have to say, no, that was not me. But this one, there's a bit of me.
And a bit of a lot of other people from the
past. And a bit of other people, too. Yeah.
Nice. It's not common knowledge that the Jews were persecuted in Greece. Had you always been aware of that, or was it something you discovered in the research of this novel?
I've always been aware of it. What I discovered was much more around Greece's involvement in both wars, both World War I and World War II, and the resistance. The Greeks were all, it's interesting how often I've been, to readings and people will say, well, I didn't know that Greece was on the Allied side. And I think even for me, even though I knew, I didn't know to what extent. And I certainly probably didn't know the extent of some of the atrocities that happened in Greece, because we hear of other atrocities but in other places, countries. There were three or four and more probably, but huge, aside from Kalavrita, which I mentioned earlier, huge massacres in Greece, in Crete, which I deal with a bit in Finding Calidora, and other places in Greece. It was quite a stronghold. It was a country that Hitler really wanted because of its accessibility to Russia. And because he was stopped in Greece, in particular in Crete, which I deal with a bit in Finding Calidora with another character, he ended up not getting to Russia until the winter, and they weren't prepared. as prepared as they could have been. So it's often, when I was doing various research for this book, it was used as, it stopped, I should say, the Nazi movement into Russia and beyond. So it's credited, Greece is credited for its role in World War II.
What are you working on now?
I'm going rogue, Heige. I'm going rogue next. I'm working on a speculative fiction piece. Who knew? I think probably this again comes back to my opinionated self. I'm really interested, but in walls and why people build walls. And I think it probably started because of the wall our neighbor there, the American, were building. I started to do some research, and it's interesting how many countries have put up walls. Again, going back to Greece, you know, lots of countries beyond Greece put up walls so that you know the refugees were stuck in Greece and couldn't go beyond. Germany has been incredible in terms of taking refugees, for example. But, you know, a lot of times the refugees want to go beyond Greece to get to Germany, and other countries in between won't allow that. In any event, it started with that. It was the question of, like, why do walls get built between people? What are the purpose? But then I started to think about, I don't think the physical walls would be built if there wasn't fear. Why is there fear? How do the physical walls relate to the personal walls that we build around ourselves? That's where it all started. I don't know where it's going, but it happens in 2056, year, start of the novel. Country isn't named. The interesting thing that I've tried to put in is, so there is a little bit of the Greek in me in this, because I have two gods of mythology who are watching what is happening and commenting. And one is the god of war, wants to, you know, to see, you know, more, because that's how you win. That's where you get your power, is through war. Whereas the other, the goddess, is Ister, is basically saying you can win in different other ways as well. And they're also enclosed in the marble that we see them in. And does, what does that represent? I have no idea what I'm doing, Heige. That's the simple answer to your question.
Well, it sounds like you're on a streak and you're going somewhere. I know about the wall, having lived in Germany and half my family living in East Germany behind the wall. And yeah, one of the things is, you know, we think of the wall that keeps people out, but it actually keeps people in.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm trying to explore, is why we would do, why would a country, even a, you know, why would they do that? What is it they're afraid of as a nation, but what is it they're afraid of as individuals as well? Because that's really what I think, it's the characters in a story that really reflect what is going on in their world. And it's also what people are interested in. They're interested in characters and how they change or not change or whatever.
Stella, it was a delight having you on A Writer's Life. I wish you all the best with your latest project. Until next time.
Thank you so much, Heige. Thank you.